This is Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang from Las Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
JBL Tour Pro 3 earbuds are for those who don't conform to the standard.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to get into some touchscreen technology, how about the smart charging case, clear sound? These are not standard things. You're only going to get them with the JBL Tour Pro 3, baby.
And I love the sound of JBL when it goes... These earbuds are packed with innovation because you can't stand out by following others.
Touchscreen smart charging case for one-touch control, instant EQ customization, true adaptive noise canceling, and the one-of-a-kind audio transmitter, which can plug and play with everything from game consoles to in-flight entertainment. What more could you want? First doesn't follow. Grab a pair at JBL.com.
Hello and welcome. You're tuned into the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. I'm Dave. That's Tim. All right, Tim. You've always had a fascination in this. I know I've given you tons of books from different authors that have passed these along to me. Secret societies. Why do you think people are so fascinated by secret societies?
You know, I think people have a fascination with the fact that they think their lives are so out of control and that people are ruling them from the outside that they can't, they essentially, Dave, they feel like they can't get control of their own lives and that other people must be responsible for the fact that they can't get control of them. That there's such a lack of control on their own part that there just has to be something else out there that's steering them the other way.
So you don't believe that there are these clandestine organizations of people that are together running and ruling parts of the world and manipulating behind the scenes?
I find it hard to believe.
Really?
I do.
You're the one that was touting how Jay-Z was part of the Illuminati. What are you doing?
I find it funny. Because you know why? And we'll get into it with Nick Redfern here a little bit later. But I find it funny that an organization that supposedly has ties to Europe and I'll even go so far as to say central white Europe, that all of a sudden they're inclusive of Jay-Z and other races. To supposedly keep themselves alive. I find it's funny that the narrative changes throughout different generations, to supposedly keep themselves alive. I think people adapt the story in order to make it, fit into the narrative of that particular generation.
All right. Well, I'm fascinated by it. I mean, are there these groups and organizations that can fast track your life, fast track your career, or can gum up the works? Nick Redfern is the guy I want to turn to. He's got a new book called Secret Societies, The Complete Guide to Histories, Rites, and Rituals. Welcome back to the show, Nick. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Hey, Dave. Thanks for having me on again.
This is fascinating. Why do you think people are so fascinated by the idea of secret societies?
Well, I think I've kind of a different approach. I think it's kind of the mystique that surrounds them that people find fascinating, the idea that there could be secret societies. And I think a lot of it comes down to people wondering what these groups might do. I don't personally hold to the idea that, you know, the Illuminati are running the planet. I think that's nonsense. But did an organization like the Illuminati exist? Yes, it did. But I think what happens in many cases is that the image and the legend actually overtakes the reality. And that's not to say secret societies don't exist. They certainly do. But for having something that's like a localized, smaller group that actually does influence people is very different to saying, you know, that there's 20 people who run the planet, which, you know, is just not feasible, as I see it, at least, anyway. But I think the mystique angle, it's the idea of clandestine meetings in underground bunkers at midnight, you know, with powerful figures. I think that's what attracts people. It's sort of the mystique and the image of what a secret society is supposed to be that fascinates people, rather than what they actually do, for sure.
Well, your book covers nearly 200 organizations and their histories and all of that. I mean, 200. I didn't even realize there were, I thought maybe there was a couple dozen of these secret societies, but I guess that's because they're such a good at keeping secrets, right, Nick?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, it's kind of like a bit of a paradox when you can have secret societies, which it isn't hard to find the names of, you know, so how secret can they be? But I think with some of these organizations, at least, it comes down to the fact that they're secret in the sense that their actions and their activities and their rituals are secret. And some of the work they do is as well. But then a lot of it is sort of, you know, like mystique that builds up around it. But yeah, I mean, you can find secret societies all over the place. The big question is it just a bunch of people who get together, you know, and have these rituals, et cetera, et cetera? Or are they actually engaged in, you know, manipulating world civilization, or is it somewhere between the two? You know, it basically revolves around having to sort of address each society on its own merit or on its own goals and aims, you know.
When you're doing this kind of research, were there a couple that stood out to you that you heard about, and as you researched them and looked into it, there was nothing to even sustain that these things exist, period?
Well, I mean, I think all the groups I talk about, they existed. But one of the things, you know, to note is that just because they existed doesn't mean they live up to the legend, so to speak. I mean, I've got, you know, an entire entry in the book on the Illuminati, but where I differ from a lot of other people who have written about the Illuminati, you know, I point out correctly that it actually came into existence in 1776. Now, before the end of the 1780s, the Illuminati was gone. I mean, that's a fact. Now, people have said, well, it wasn't gone. It went underground, and it has, you know, all these secret connections, and when somebody becomes president or prime minister or powerful figures, they get brought into this order. But there's actually no hard evidence that the Illuminati existed after 1787. It was created in 1776 by Adam Weishaupt in Ingolstadt, Bavaria. And he was like a powerful figure, but he was also a professor of religious law. He was heavily involved in the occult. And he created this group, which grew and grew. And it had a network around Europe of powerful figures. But then over time, as I said, it collapsed. And if you look into the history, you find it did close down in 1787. But you'll find people today who say, no, it's still going on. It's still around. They may not have that name anymore. But, you know, you have to prove that. And that's why my entry in the book, you know, is 2 pages and not 20 pages, because the extra 18 pages would be basically just guessing and scenarios and, you know, ideas, but not facts. The facts are it didn't last. And yet it's still, but this is what I mean about the mystery and the intrigue. People still gravitate to the stories of the Illuminati. Oh, they're running the planet. Most people who say that don't actually realize or bother to check when the group existed and when it didn't exist.
Nick, I gotta throw this at you real quick. As long as we're on the subject of the Illuminati, recently you had the passing of David Rockefeller, and if there is any family that's been tied to the supposed Illuminati more, it's been the Rockefeller family. And recently, I guess one of the huge flag wavers for the Rockefeller family is Charlie Rose, and I watched a lot of Charlie Rose, especially around the time that David Rockefeller passed away. And Charlie was very close to the Rockefellers, and here we can go down this rabbit hole for a minute. And also close to the Rockefellers was the Bush family. And so you get everybody talking about, oh my gosh, you know, the Rockefellers. That's the when you hear the Bilderberg Conference, you hear about the Rockefellers sitting around the table and the fact that this is the heart of the Illuminati. And when David Rockefeller died, the head was cut off the snake. And by gosh, you know, the Illuminati was weakened. Well, or you hear the, you know, the there's one less seat at the Bilderberg Conference, you know, and you know, when you hear stuff like this, when you hear stuff like this as a researcher, knowing that essentially the Illuminati was done as of the 1800s, do you roll your eyes at this? You know, when you see Charlie Rose on TV talk about what a humanitarian David Rockefeller was and how his family was involved in advancing the arts in America, and you hear somebody trumpeting the Rockefellers and what they brought to charity in America, and then you hear someone like Alex Jones going off about how the Rockefellers are bringing about the corruption in America with the Illuminati, do you roll your eyes at that as a researcher, or do you lend some credence to it?
Well, the problem, as I, you know, the problem is twofold. One is that the Illuminati, like I said, you know, shut down in 1787. And the other problem I have is that if somebody is going to make a solid case that the Illuminati literally still exists as the Illuminati, or that there are other organizations which maybe have sort of taken up the mantle of the Illuminati, but under different names, or the Illuminati still exists and under that name, but it's buried so deeply that they never mention it, so it, you know, it remains hidden. The problem I have is when it comes to trying to validate those stories. You know, we can validate the early history of the Illuminati, validating the idea that they still exist and that they're running the planet and they still have that name. You know, good luck trying to find evidence. And by evidence, I don't mean endless tales on the internet. I mean actual evidence and facts. And that's not to say, and, you know, don't get me wrong, I'm not playing it down and saying that there aren't significant groups that have influenced the world stage, because there are. But in saying that, that's not the same as saying that the Illuminati have got, you know, key figures in every government around the planet, you know, and they're doing this and they're doing that. That hasn't been proved. And so, you know, I wish people would explain, or, you know, to their listeners or readers or viewers more, that when you're talking about the Illuminati, talk about what we know for sure versus talk about what we don't know for sure, and make sure that your audience understands what is fact and what is hypothesis or just scenarios, you know, ideas.
Because a lot of times you find that because David Rockefeller did come out and not just hint at, but essentially said that he would be in favor of a one world government, because in his business, which was banking, he focused on expanding his banking business, yeah, worldwide. So essentially, he was in favor of a one world government because he could consolidate his business under one world government and essentially expand his empire to every single corner of the globe.
I agree with you on that. That was his position. You know, he felt that the planet and him and, you know, everything else would benefit from having a one world government. But the important thing is, a lot of people would say, well, that's evidence of the Illuminati trying to run the planet. Well, no, what actually is, it's, you know, it's people, famous people, making a statement how they would like to see the planet run. And maybe there are people who are pushing it down that path to try and lead us towards a world government. But in saying that, that's still not making a 100% case that it's the Illuminati that's doing it. It just means that there are certain powerful figures who are trying to push us down that path. Now, that's very different than saying, you know, that he's part of that Rockefeller was part of the Illuminati, and his position in the Illuminati was ABC for 10 years and then DEF for something else. That's the angle that hasn't been proved. So, you know, you have to be be very careful just because somebody's looking for world government and somebody says, well, that person's in the Illuminati. That doesn't make it actually correct. It means they may be tied to a secret society or secret order or something. But you know, you have to look at the scope of it, or in some cases, the lack of scope. You know, very often secret societies do a lot of weird stuff and are quite powerful, but they're sort of very much localized to certain countries or areas even. You know, they're not sort of think groups with worldwide connections in many cases.
Well, and the one thing that always gets me about this, and you're kind of hitting home the point that I've always believed in too, especially when it comes to the Rockefellers, and correct me if I'm wrong here, and you tell me if you think this way as well. So here's the deal. David Rockefeller and the Rockefeller family come along and say, well, we're a worldwide banking organization. We believe in one world government because essentially it puts more money in our pockets. And then yet one of the bylines of the Illuminati is to limit the world population to give me the magic number here, Nick. The magic number is...
Well, I mean, I've heard everything from sort of like 750 million to about 2 billion, you know.
Right. But originally, I think the original Illuminati charter said 500,000, wasn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, but that's just not feasible. You'd be in danger of actually becoming extinct. You
right.
Know,
and
that low.
In the 1700s, the original charter is 500,000 people, and that's what they want to eliminate the population to. So the idea being, if this huge banker who's depending on a huge population to generate revenue, to put money in his pocket and make him even richer, is looking to eliminate the population, he's looking essentially to cut his business in half, which makes, to me, absolutely no sense.
Well, yeah, I mean, I see where you're coming from, but I mean, this sort of also sort of plays into the other side of thing where the other side of things where, you know, you do have people who have openly stated, you know, that they would like to see the population of the planet reduced. I mean, that's a fact. I mean, you can go back.
Oh, sure.
For example, to the 1970s, there was a United States National Security Council report, and it was titled Implications of Worldwide Population Growth for U.S. Security and Overseas Interests. That was the title of the report, and it actually talks about finding ways to lower the population. You know, I mean, that's a fact. That's not like a, you know, like a leaked purportedly hoax document. That's sort of a, you know, a real document. And I mean, like, for example, Prince Philip, the you know, Queen Elizabeth's husband in England, you know, he's spoken out extensively about how and why the population should be lowered. You know, so in that sense, there are people who dearly do want to see the world's human population reduced, and reduced drastically. But does that mean, you know, that there are nefarious characters in some bio lab deep underground engineering viruses to wipe out 5 billion, you know? That's the leap of faith that some people take just because research is being done into viruses. So then they make the connection that, well, you know, this group's making these viruses and somebody who's funded it happens to be in the banking community. So, you know, but obviously there's a link there, and they're all connected, and they're all involved in trying to lower the population. That is how conspiracy theories often develop. But I try, where possible, to remain grounded and go with the facts, rather make this leap and, you know, put all these strands and leads together, which could mean something. But on the other hand, it could just mean you're putting leads and strands together, you know.
One of the when you're talking about this, Illuminati jumps to mind. One of the other most, I don't know if it's misunderstood or miscalculated or whatever organizations, are the Freemasons. And, you know, we actually, in our first year, we had a fascinating show. I thought we talked to this guy, Wayne Herschel, out of South Africa, who was talking about some of his finds and how he believed he could prove that, you know, we came from the stars, and he had a great story. But he firmly believed, this really intelligent mind believed, the Freemasons were trying to kill him because he was trying to share this information. And I mean, at first we thought it was a joke. This guy was dead serious. He was terrified that the Freemasons were coming for him. How does the Freemasons who my understanding was this was a group that was set up to do good and be good. And people I know that are Freemasons, they have to have a belief in some kind of God and some kind of good order. You know, how did they go from that PR to they're running the undercurrent of the world and can kill with a glance and save your life with a whisper? How does that happen?
Well, I think it happens purely and simply for one very simple reason, that they develop like a legend, if you like, or an image of being a secret society. And if you mention secret societies to most people, they take the view that, well, if it's a secret society, it's got to be doing something bad or conspiratorial or dangerous, you know, to the rest of us, or they're trying to control us. So it's just the very fact that it's not so much that the Freemasons exist that makes people suspicious. It's because it's become known as a secret society. And as I said, you know, most people, whether they believe in them or not, have an image of what the term secret society means. It means people dressed in robes, usually men, usually rich and powerful, having meetings, you know, in sort of the cellars of huge mansions or, you know, that kind of thing, performing rituals and rites and trying to engineer certain events in the world. And that's all stems just from those two words, secret society. So I think, you know, I actually know a few Freemasons. They're not Dr. Frankenstein, you know, or anything like that. But a lot of their activities are, you know, clandestine. But that doesn't necessarily mean because they're clandestine that there's anything sinister. You know, other people will take another approach, you know, because they've crossed paths with them and, you know, their view is completely different. But again, you know, it does come down to the issue of just the term, you know, a secret society and what it implies. It's kind of like, you know, if somebody brings up the issue, the word conspiracy,
right.
You know, I mean, you could have three people involved in a conspiracy. Most people might think of a conspiracy something involving 20 or 30, and it has to involve the government, you know. It's just certain words just provoke certain images.
Yeah, the idea that the Freemasons are this brutal secret society, they've got to be the worst kept secret on planet Earth, because I see Mason halls everywhere, and I know a bunch of Masons. And, it's fascinating to me that, you know, in your research, do you believe that they kind of are a keeper of the flame, or have they allowed their legend to grow so that they seem this all-powerful entity? You know, I mean, they've got ties to the Lost Ark. They've got ties to the Holy Grail. They've got ties to the cross Christ was crucified on. They've got, you know, ties to every major important historical event. You know, does that make it that they're really a part of it, or, you know, that's a subsection of members, and you get enough subsection, you've got kind of that 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon thing happening?
Yeah, that's what I actually think a lot of things that go on. I'm not just, like I said, I do actually believe there are powerful people who are trying to manipulate world opinion on different things, particularly, you know, and I think that is going on. But, you know, when you talk about the whole Kevin Bacon scenario, yes, you know, you can find links and threads just by looking. Now, whether it means these connections are actually evidence of something conspiratorial, or just because when you go looking, you can make these connections, you know, and that's one of the big problems when you're dealing with conspiracy theories as they relate to secret societies, that, you know, you're in a situation where how far do you go with it? You know, I mean, like I said, about people influencing, you know, the world stage and things like that. I mean, I actually do think, you know, there are people in, you know, powerful people who kind of want to isolate the United States from the rest of the world, you know, make America fearful of the rest of the world and, you know, essentially, you know, isolate the nation. I actually do think there are people who want that. Now, whether there is some sort of group that is actively working to do that, that's a very different issue, you know. So, in other words, it depends. Are you just talking about a couple of guys who get together and try and figure out how they can engineer what it is they want doing, or is there an active program to do that, you know?
Well, let's start dipping into the different organizations out there. You know, we've heard the Illuminati. We've already kind of talked a little bit about the Freemasons. You know, of course, one of the ones that has one of the most powerful and creepy cool names is the Skull and Bones Society. What can you tell our listeners about that?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, when you look at one of the important things about, you know, when you're dealing with a secret society, really, is the name of it, you know. And things like that sort of, you know, they become, you know, they become not just sort of well-known, but they're sort of revered, but just the name itself. But Skull and Bones actually sort of goes back to the early 1800s, early 1832, actually, at Yale University in Connecticut. And the founders were William Huntingdon Russell, who was a businessman and actually a powerful figure in the Republican Party, and a man named Alfonso Taft. Now, under President Ulysses Grant, he held the positions of the Secretary of War and the Attorney General. And so, in other words, from the very beginning, Skull and Bones typified what it means to be a secret society with powerful figures and things like that. Now, in terms of, you know, exactly what Skull and Bones does, you know, again, you know, most people would say it's sort of a, you know, like a benevolent fraternal kind of society, you know, but then you have other people who say, well, you have these people in high politics, etc., getting involved, and that you find, for example, they're tied in with like Rockefellers and not just powerful business people, but intelligence agencies and the Council for Foreign Relations. And then you have all these groups blended in to where the, you know, the original Skull and Bones and its goals and so forth become part of some huge umbrella operation that is, you know, running everything. So that, you know, it's sort of, and you know, they're also tied in, you know, again, with big money. So a lot of these organizations, you can find the same sort of strands and threads running all the way through them. But again, it's sometimes the mystique and the mystery overwhelms the reality. And
right, and I know again, some of the, why, yeah. You've got some of the titles, right? The Stonemasons, Freemasons, you've got the Illuminati, you've got the Skull and Bone Society. And like I said, I know that sometimes the name, the strength of the name can lend its own part of the fable to it. But what about the Odd Fellows? Now that, you know, you're obviously from the UK. When I think of Odd Fellows, I just think that it's definitely a group that the Monty Python crew have put together, right? I just see John Cleese leading the Order of the Odd Fellows. But what are the Odd Fellows, and what did they do? How did they, what was their point?
Well, I mean, I actually don't cover the Odd Fellows in the book at all. It's you know, it's one of those things which I, you know, I don't know too much about, but it was so obscure that I kind of actually left that one out. So.
Or did you do it because they forced you to, because they were manipulating you and had your pet hamster held out? I got you.
Phone calls.
Yeah. All right. Well, talk to me about some of your favorite groups and some of these weird rituals and rites that go behind them. I want to do that when we return. We've got to take a quick break. Okay. The book, again, is Secret Societies, The Complete Guide to History's Rites and Rituals. Nick Redfern, our guest tonight.
Darkness.
We're back as we take a look into secret societies, histories, rites, and rituals. Our guest, Nick Redfern, this evening, as we talk about these. I'm always, like I said, I'm just fascinated by this topic on the whole, and the idea that there are these different organizations and groups. You know, we talked about it on Tuesday's show, and we've talked about it before with the conspiracies. Do you believe people jump on this bandwagon so easily, Nick, because they don't want to believe that bad things just happened? There has to be some undercurrent of nefarious activity that makes it occur?
Well, yeah, that definitely happens sometimes. You know, I mean, I see that actually, you know, I write a lot about UFOs, and I often see that in the UFO subject that, you know, I've had people tell me that, you know, they were going to phone a friend and talk about a case and the phone wasn't working. Well, you know, and they view that as suspicious, but it may just be that the phone wasn't working properly, you know. I think when you start going down the path that, you know, you're investigating something sinister or perceived sinister, and there are people that may not want you to look into it, and you get up the next morning and your car's parked outside and it's got a flat tire, and, you know, and then, like I said, your phone doesn't work properly, then that kind of gets weaved into the conspiracy that somebody's after you. And it can be, I've seen people, it get quite dangerous to go down that path where everything becomes part of some vast group trying to stop you or destabilize you, when it may just be that there was a screw up on the phone line and, you know, you happened to get a little chunk of metal in the car on the way home and it was a slow puncture and, you know, it was flat by the morning, you know. And you have to be very careful in these subjects not to get so dragged in that your entire life revolves around peering through the blinds. You know, that's a dangerous path to go down.
I'm glad you brought that up, because Tim, sitting across from me, he sees dark shadows everywhere he looks. With all the bad luck he has, he's pretty sure that the Secret Society of 11 Herbs and Spices, all of the multitude of Illuminati Colonel Sanders, are out to try to ruin his life because he moved to Chick-fil-A as his favorite chicken place.
I think so, yeah.
Oh, dear. Yeah. Well, I think, you know, that's, you know, you've kind of sealed your fate now, I guess.
It's God, he's backing up your concern,
yeah, I
Tim.
Know. It's all Rob Lowe's fault. I'm going to throw a scenario and a question at you here, Nick. Here's the deal, okay? I'm going to throw two organizations at you, the Freemasons and the Knights of Columbus. And here's your question. Where is the dividing line between good and evil with secret societies? Because one has a stellar reputation, one doesn't have a stellar reputation, but they both do good acts. They both go out into the community. They both go out and they fund hospitals. They go out and they fund charitable acts. They go out and they do things for the community. Yet one has a not so stellar reputation and has a reputation for doing some not so great things. And one has a stellar reputation that you could give the white glove treatment. So where is the line? How do we determine that one organization's good and then the other is not so good?
Well, a lot of it comes to, again, like a misunderstanding. Again, a lot of it comes down to, like, the name of the group, which, you know, if a group sounds mysterious or it's an enigmatic name, then the group must be mysterious and enigmatic. So almost like by default, there's this, when you hear the names, you know, what are they up to? You know, and that's just, you know, the inevitable way that the human mind works. And I say, if you couple with that with the fact that whether benevolent or not, all these groups tend to have their own sort of little cliques and their, you know, ways of working and their rituals and their rites and behind closed door things, all of those kind of ingredients, you know, you put them all in the pot and stir it around, and then you have people who kind of view them with suspicion. It's you know, regardless of how much good work a secret group may do, people will say, well, that's just a cover for, you know, the bad they're doing. So, you know, for some of these groups, it's you know, you could almost say, well, it's your own fault for having such an enigmatic name and doing everything behind closed doors, even if it's for good reasons. You know, it's like, do it a bit more in the open and don't have such a mysterious kind of title. You know?
That's right, Tim. And you should think about that while you're with your bronies group.
Well,
the Rainbow Brighties and the Bronies, if you guys would just bring it out into the public instead of hiding behind doors.
But here's the thing.
Multicolored,
Dave,
doors, we'd understand.
We
better
totally fund giving My Little Ponies to orphanages everywhere. Mm-hmm. And just because we meet behind closed doors and we order tubs of lubricant and and have My Little Pony costumes has nothing to do with the fact that we don't do good things in the community.
Bronies, you can feel free to send Tim your hate mail at tim@darknessradio.com. Let's talk about some of the histories, rites, and rituals of these groups. I think that's part of what makes people so interested as well. You know, I've got friends that joined and became Freemasons, and talking to them, sometimes it sounds so ridiculous. I want to laugh at them because they're like, "Oh, I can't tell you, man. We had to do this." And
well, I mean,
are there cloaks? Are there paddle boards? What? And no, I can't tell you. I can't tell you.
Well, I mean, a perfect example, you know, when you talked about their origins and things like that. I mean, one of the stranger ones that I talk about in the book was a case or a cult, if you like, that existed or began at least in the late 1960s at, of all places possible, Loch Ness, Scotland. And there's a two-page entry on this in the book. And what happened was that in the late 1960s, a Loch Ness monster researcher named Ted Holliday, who used to go to Loch Ness regularly every year, he uncovered evidence of a dragon-worshipping cult at Loch Ness. And this is a very sort of disturbing story. This particular group, they were reportedly powerful Scottish business people and people in politics in Scotland, and they reportedly, or allegedly, worshipped this ancient Babylonian sea goddess named Tiamat, which was like, you know, like a sea serpent type monster kind of creature, and they would perform rites and rituals to Tiamat, this, as I said, this ancient Babylonian sea goddess, as a means to try and acquire sort of power, influence, money, sex, you know, the whole thing that secret societies, you know, we're told go after. And there were also dark rumors of human sacrifice going on in the woods around Loch Ness that surround the loch, to the extent that the Scottish police force actually got involved in this. And there were even rumors that the police force deliberately kind of steered away from it because some of the more powerful people in the police force were supposedly linked to this group. Now, you know, as you talk about their origins and things like this, you know, their entire history, if you like, and their scenario of what they believed in and how, you know, they could achieve power and wealth, actually went back, you know, not just a few years. Well, you know, with plans and ideas, they went back thousands of years. And as I said, praying to this sea goddess deity in Babylonian culture. So, in other words, some of these groups that exist today, or certainly existed back in the 60s and 70s with this group, you know, their origins, at least, so to speak, and their beliefs went back literally thousands of years. And although eventually the police dropped the case, they did find circumstantial evidence of sort of these strange worships going on in the woods. There's no doubt about that. What they didn't prove was that there had been human sacrifice. But, I mean, that, you know, that sort of takes you from the 20th century to sort of, you know, 2000 BC or whatever.
Did you uncover any of these that did involve human sacrifice in modern times and or, you know, darker storylines?
I mean, a classic one, which is kind of a grisly one, but, you know, I cover this extensively in the book, occurred in England just not more than a few more years ago. It was actually 2001, and I said it was a bit of a grisly story. The River Thames, which is a famous river which runs through London, on September the 21st, the body of a young African-American boy was found floating in the River Thames, but it was just his torso. There was no head, no arms, no legs. And when obviously it was, you know, somebody found it and the police came quickly and it was dragged out. And when the autopsy was taken, the body had been drained of blood. Now, using DNA tests, they were actually able to confirm that, you know, this boy was actually young African boy. The more they dug into it and they found that the way in which he'd been killed, it actually tied in with certain secret societies in Africa that performed sort of ritualistic killings in this very fashion. And this was actually an investigation that took some of the senior personnel from Scotland Yard right across to Africa. You know, there were, you know, flights out to try and figure out exactly, you know, who had killed this boy and under what circumstances. And a lot of it, although a lot of it was circumstantial and the case was never fully resolved, although there were suspicions about a few people. A lot of it went back to sort of African voodoo cults. But the very fact that they were working clandestinely in the heart of London in 2001, that kind of gives you sort of another angle on secret societies, not the kind of secret society that wants to take over the world, but like the Loch Ness one and like this River Thames one, where you have a relatively small secret society, but that is performing sort of abominable acts, again, you know, for financial gain or monetary, you know, business, etc. It's all about like a Faustian pact, you know, you do a deal with, you know, something paranormal, and then you achieve something in return. But to find out, you know, in 2001, you know, the start of the 21st century, one of these clandestine voodoo cults was operating in central London. You know, that goes to show sort of the sheer bizarreness of how some of these secret societies exist and how they can be under our very noses. They're not manipulating the planet, but in their own way, they're performing something that they see as, you know, as power bringing, so to speak.
All right, a couple more examples of your favorite very bizarre organizations and their rituals.
Well, I guess one of the strangest one, which is kind of a little bit sort of lighthearted after that one. There's a secret society dedicated to the late actor Lee Marvin, which is kind of strange when you think about it.
What?
But yeah, have you not heard of that one?
No, I have not. So wait, you didn't deem the Oddfellows important enough, but you went after one that where people worship Lee Marvin?
Well, in a very strange, I have to say, in a very strange way, yes.
Okay.
I mean, basically, I'll tell you the story behind this because it is kind of an interesting one. It's actually called the Sons of Lee Marvin, and it goes back to the 1980s when a few people got together to sort of create this organization, and there was one criteria. I mean, it's actually like. It's actually not really a secret society, but it's presented as a secret society. It's in essence, it's kind of like, you know, it's just a bit of fun more than anything else. But the one criteria is that you have to look like Lee Marvin. And two of the people who are members of the Sons of Lee Marvin are Tom Waits and Nick Cave, who, if you look at them, they actually do look a bit like Lee Marvin.
Right.
And, you know, it's all done sort of very much, you know, tongue-in-cheek and kind of, you know, poking fun at real secret societies. But yeah, the Sons of Lee Marvin is like this sort of semi-official bunch of friends who get together and they provide, and you look like Lee Marvin, you know, you can get into the group. So.
Are there any of these organizations that you find do have power to help move people up and shuffle things around and... You know, I know that was part of the Freemasons and some of the other deals was that, you know, once you're in, man, you've got the golden path before you. And I know a lot of Freemasons who that is not the case. I'm wondering, where did that come from? And are there any groups that do seem to fast track you and help you get pointed in the right direction or, you know, make problems go away?
Well, you mean by problems, you mean people who are problematic for them, you mean?
I don't know that I can be more specific at this time. Right. No. Well, anything. Just, you know, whether they're having problems with their life, finances, people, you know, there are organizations that do seem to have that kind of covert power. And
I see what you mean. Well, there are. But again, you know, it's always kind of like a Faustian pact. You know, we'll do something for you if you do something for us. And, you know, that's the way things have always been. And sometimes, you know, that can cause a lot of problems for people. I mean, for example, one of the groups that I talk about in the book has become known as the Octopus. Now, from their perspective, you know, what they're doing and who they're recruiting is for the goal that they feel is the right one. But for the rest of the planet, it's not the right one. It's kind of like one of these groups that allegedly wants to sort of, you know, manipulate the planet around, you know, their kind of belief systems and goals, and if you'll do something for them to help them, you get recruited on board. But this is a very sort of sinister story. It goes back to August 1991 and the death of an investigative journalist named Danny Casolaro. He was found dead in a hotel room in Martinsburg, West Virginia. And up until the point of his death, Casolaro was actually deeply investigating this group that he called the Octopus. That wasn't its official title, but it was linked with supposedly linked with all sorts of different phenomena and different secrets and conspiracies, such as the Cuban Missile Crisis, Watergate, the December 1988 destruction of a Boeing 747 over Lockerbie, Scotland, Area 51, UFOs, all sorts of different things. And Casolaro was someone who, although he ended up dead in this particular hotel room, and what was interesting, but kind of sinister as well, was the fact that the cuts to both wrists suggested suicide, but one of the people involved in the autopsy said the cuts were so deep that if you'd slash so deeply, say, on your left wrist, you would not physically have the power in that hand anymore to perform the same act on your right hand. People don't realize that. Mm. You know, you sever so deeply, that hand's almost sort of paralyzed. But he was reportedly approached by the group to come inside, come on board, and we'll explain why we feel we're doing the right thing. You know, so again, it's that, as you bring up, you know, you do the right thing for us, we'll do the right thing for you. And he said no. And from their perspective, that was the wrong thing. And a couple of books, really good, interesting books, have been written about Danny Casolaro and his quest to uncover the truth of this octopus, which was not sort of like a solid group that met, but a bunch of people all around the planet that occasionally would get together and try and influence certain things to go their way, which seems to me more feasible than the idea you have 200 men, you know, who are literally running the planet, you know.
All right. That's another fascinating story. Was there ever anything that he was able to uncover before his untimely death? Was there any names, anything he could seriously look at?
Well, that's the problem. I mean, a lot of his files vanished after he died, and he was planning on writing a full-length book on all this, and that, you know, makes it even more sort of suspicious. But he did view sort of the major, you know, events of the post-war 20th century. As I said, Cuban Missile Crisis, JFK assassination, Watergate, Iran-Contra. He felt that these people, you know, they weren't sort of running these events, but they were subtly influencing the people. You know, say, for example, should we go to war with this country? Well, you know, if it's sort of one of his arguments was that a lot of wars were engineered to essentially increase the economy, you know, by building up helicopters, tanks, etc. And he felt that, you know, while they weren't running the wars, they were subtly speaking to people, say, hey, you know, maybe we should invade this country. And that the reason might be, you know, that the group, the Octopus, wanted this done was to try and, you know, increase the economy rather than have a legitimate reason for a war. So that those were the kind of things that he was looking into at the time of his death. And, you know, it's one of these kind of conspiracy theories that sort of still exist. You know, it sort of still permeates in conspiracy theory fields.
You write about a lot of deep, dark secrets of different ideas and things. Are you ever threatened? Are you ever contacted by members saying, do not do this, Nick, get off of that trail?
No, that's never happened. And, you know, people would say, well, that's because everything you're investigating is not legitimate. You know, that's nonsense. But again, you know, I think part of it comes down, I mean, not, you know, I'm not any different to anybody else, but ironically, for all the work I do into UFOs, conspiracies, Men in Black, I'm really not a paranoid person. You know, I really don't peer out the windows, and I don't worry if, you know, the electric goes off 10 minutes before I'm about to do a radio show and we have to cancel and do it again. You know, that's not some hidden hand, you know, hacking into the electric system so we can't do the interview. It's just bad luck. And now I have had some weird experiences with people who wanted to share stories. You know, elderly guys in the military want to talk about their knowledge of UFOs and that kind of thing. I get quite a lot of, you know, contacts like that. But that's very different to, you know, having a black car following you around town and, weird, you know, anonymous letters left stamped on the front door, you know, packing this in or else, you know. No, nothing like that has ever happened. People have said, well, you should say that it has. It'd be more mystique for your books. I said, well, yeah, but the problem is it hasn't happened, so I can't say that, you know.
Well, you've written a lot about UFO culture and Bigfoot, or I'm sorry, UFO and, monsters as well, but the Men in Black phenomena. Are the Men in Black a secret society, do you believe?
Well, I included them in the book because in some respects, yes, they are. You know, there's sort of this order of these strange characters that dress in one fashion, you know, the black suits, skinny black ties, even the old-style black fedoras, and very often they're described as driving old-style, you know, 1950s black cars, you know, Cadillac, Chevys, that kind of thing. And they do come across like a secret society. As I said, they have their own kind of uniform almost. They typically, you know, threaten people, but not to the point of killing them. And they also have this atmosphere of authority, you know, which often sort of intimidates a lot of people. But the big difference between the Men in Black in the movies and the Men in Black in the real world, you know, according to the witnesses, most people describe the real Men in Black as actually not looking completely human, as bizarre as that might sound. They're always sort of extremely pale, you know, like the skin's the color of a sheet of paper, and they're very gaunt, and their eyes kind of bulge behind these wraparound sunglasses they wear. And this has given rise to the idea that, you know, I know this gets away from secret societies per se and more into UFO conspiracies, but a lot of people think they are kind of like a secret society, but are they even a human secret society, you know, or are they something alien that is preventing us from getting the truth of the UFO mystery? So, you know, the Men in Black mystery, when you look into it, goes down some really weird pathways. Now, what's particularly interesting, though, is that Brad Steiger, a long-term researcher of, you know, paranormal phenomena and conspiracies, found that back 300-500 years ago, Men in Black types were being reported then, but instead of going around threatening people who'd seen UFOs, they were knocking on the doors of people who were interested in the field of alchemy. You know, alchemy is this ancient ability, so to speak, to turn what are called base metals like tin and lead into precious metals like gold and silver. And alchemists were typically tied to secret societies way back then, you know, the sort of the mystical occult angle of these groups. You know, they would have people on board who supposedly could transform, as I said, tin into gold. So, you know, you do have very odd links between secret societies and the Men in Black. And, you know, it's almost like a surreal type scenario when you start digging into these Men in Black ties to, you know, these clandestine orders, and, you know, somebody's making them or telling them to come out late at night and threaten these people, and, you know, they're all dressed the same, you know, the clothing never changes.
Do most of the rights of these different organizations, do they change as history progresses, or do they a lot of times stay in kind of the medieval rights that they originally were started in?
Yeah. Well, that's a good question, because a lot of these groups actually are quite unchanging, not necessarily in the work they do, but the kind of rituals they perform and the oaths they take and the pledges. All of those are pretty much steeped in exactly the same designs, if you like, when they were first created, whether 50 years ago or 300 years ago. Very little in that sense, you know, changes. You know, people have this image of, as I said, kind of almost like a laughable image of clandestine midnight meetings in some underground building. But that is actually how a lot of them work. And I think, you know, there's no need for them to do it that way. But I think, again, they kind of almost unconsciously or subconsciously feel, well, if they're a secret order, it's just not right to kind of do it in somebody's living room, you know. And I mean, I'm not making light of it, but that's how it comes across,
right,
almost. You've got this vibe.
Sure, you've got this vibe of secrecy, and you kind of the underground layer seems like a much more cool and impressive deal than, yes, we're getting together. We're, Tim and I and Nick Redfern, and we're going to talk about how we're going to manipulate the world. We're going to change the economy, the religions, and I'll meet you guys at my mom's house on Saturday. Make sure you bring cheese because we're going to have grilled cheese sandwiches. Tim, you bring the tomato soup.
All right.
That would seem to make it a lot less impactful sounding, doesn't it?
Well, it does. And I mean, you know, a perfect example, which I guess in a fictional form, the one example of how a secret society kind of works for you know, the general public would probably be like a movie like Eyes Wide Shut, you know, with Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman, which was, you know, it's presented, you know, the group is presented as like a secret society and their implications and inferences concerning alleged powerful people. But I think the imagery in the movie is what a lot of people, you know, take a secret society to be. And in some respects, you know, that is how they work. But, you know, to what extent they are doing something that is dangerous or world-changing, or is it something more localized, or is it just an excuse, you know, for a good time, you know? You can look at it in all different ways. Secret society, the term, can mean very different things to different people, and that includes the people in the secret societies as well.
Do any of these secret societies, do we know if any of them did work side by side with different versions of law enforcement, be FBI, CIA, NSA, police, fraternal orders, anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, I can tell you a really strange one that goes back to the Second World War, which is in the book. Now, most people have heard of the infamous occultist Aleister Crowley. Well, Aleister Crowley was linked with numerous secret societies, occult orders, and things like this from the latter part of the 1800s and through to his death in 1947. And, you know, many of these groups did revolve around, you know, sort of ancient history, ancient orders, the occult, things like this. But in the very early stages of the Second World War, when there were actually deep concerns that Hitler just might win the war, a very strange approach was made by British intelligence, actually MI5, which is the British equivalent of the FBI. MI5 clandestinely approached Crowley and actually asked him if any of these sort of occult-based groups that he was in, did they have any rituals or powers which could actually stave off the Nazi attacks? Was there any way that they could use the supernatural to try and keep Hitler at bay? And reportedly, whether they worked or not, reportedly Crowley came on board and was sort of like a clandestine agent of British intelligence trying to, as I said, prevent the Nazis from winning, but doing so, there's a reason why I got confused, I'll tell you. But a lot of the women, the people who were brought on board were women who were witches. And so you had this strange situation where you had these women who were performing these occult rituals in the offices of the intelligence world and trying to concentrate on essentially kind of dispatching a sense of bad luck in the direction of the Nazis and to try and prevent them from winning the war. So a very, very strange situation. You imagine kind of a parallel today if you had, you know, agents of one particular government organization, and then you have these sort of, you know, witches come in the room and perform their rituals to try and wipe out, you know, the power, if you like, or the danger posed by North Korea. It'd be kind of like that approach. And a lot of these people, the women that were brought on board in the Second World War by British intelligence, were attached to these clandestine societies that that Crowley was linked to. So, you know, it's a very odd scenario.
I thought there was actually a part of that story where the witches did get together on some platform where they focused intention and it stopped an oncoming aerial attack. Isn't there a story like that?
Yeah, it was known as the Cone of Power, and that was just one of these. You know, not all of them occurred, you know, deep in the heart of the intelligence building. Several of them occurred in ancient woods in England, particularly on the east coast of England, which sort of bordered mainland Europe. And they would, you know, focus their energies on crossing the English Channel and across France and Holland and on their way to Germany, and then just try and focus their minds onto trying to negate the power and influence of the Nazis. And this Cone of Power ritual, that was actually performed on more than a few occasions. And now, we did win the war, so, you know, some people might say, well, there you go, you know, it worked. But then on the other hand, maybe it was just down to the fact that we won out in the end, you know, and had nothing to do with the Cone of Power. But on the other hand, it does demonstrate how, at times, governments will actually employ the use of groups and people who are tied to these kind of groups for some sort of, like, military advantage, you know.
Yeah, that's a very intriguing part of the whole history and what was involved. I love these kind of stories. And again, he covers over 200 different secret organizations in the new book, Secret Societies, The Complete Guide to Histories, Rites, and Rituals. And we'll keep our fingers crossed for you, Nick, that eventually you piss somebody off enough that they threaten you so you can even come back with a cooler book.
Well, if that happened, you know, I mean, I would put it in the book. I wouldn't hide it. But honestly, you know, that just hasn't happened. And I have to wonder, you know, when a lot of people say that they have been threatened or weird things have happened, maybe it has. But on the other hand, maybe sometimes it's just bad luck happens, you know, or something that seems sinister becomes part of the you know, the bigger picture. And when it's actually not, you know, it's always important when you're investigating these things not to get paranoid and carried away. You know, it's important to have a normal life as well.
Hey, thank you so much for joining us, Nick. I know you're always busy and on the road and working and putting out your next book. What is your next book going to be out?
Oh, it's actually a very different book. It comes out in September. It's called Shapeshifters, and it's like a study throughout history, mythology, and folklore of animals or people sort of transforming into different things. You know, there's a lot of people think of werewolves, but, you know, in Africa there are leopard cults where people believe that they can transform themselves into leopards. And then in Native American lore over here, you have the skinwalkers, which are allegedly can change their form. So that's basically the theme of it. It's a study through history, folklore, mythology of so-called shapeshifters.
Great. When does that come out?
September.
We'll have to have you back then. I appreciate it, Nick. You take care of yourself, be safe, and we'll talk to you again soon, sir.
All right. Thanks, guys. See you later.
Thank you. We'll be back tomorrow. Avia Bell Moon will be our guest, and we're going to talk about Spirit Land, her weird encounters with the paranormal, and some of California's Central Coast haunts. We'll do that when we return tomorrow on the best in Paranormal Talk Radio. This is Beyond the Darkness.
Looking for excitement? Chumba Casino is here. Play anytime, play anywhere. Play on the train, play at the store, play at home, play when you're bored. Play today for your chance to win and get daily bonuses when you log in. So what are you waiting for? Don't delay. Chumba Casino is free to play.
Experience social gameplay like never before. Go to Chumba Casino right now to play hundreds of games, including online slots, bingo, Slingo, and more. Live the Chumba life at ChumbaCasino.com.
Terms and conditions apply. When it comes to broccoli salad, Ohio, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. Everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows that tangy zip. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip in all your favorite recipes. Buy now and get your tang on, Ohio.
This time of year, most of us are checking off our holiday gift lists. But identity thieves have lists too, and your personal information might be on them. Protect your identity with LifeLock. LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second and alerts you to threats you could miss. If your identity is stolen, LifeLock will fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. Make this season about joy, not identity theft, with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.